Welcome to the Unveiled Podcast. My name is Peg Peters. I'm your host. This is the podcast where we are exploring the intersection of psychedelics and spirituality. And we're having on different guests and authors, really looking at this renaissance of psychedelics in our world. But really, how do we move from just, you know, as Houston Smith once said, you know, move from changing our, you know, the state that we're in to actually changing the traits, right? Moving from, and so that's kind of what we're trying to explore on this podcast. And I've got a guest today, Stephen Gray. Stephen is in Vancouver here with me locally. He is an author. He is a teacher, an artist, a thinker. He's written a recent book that I've been really fascinated with that we're going to really dive into today. But it's you know, Stephen, you are one of these, I don't know how to pin you down, because you've been doing this work for so long. You're one of these, you know, I call them oak trees. We've got a lot of bamboo trees. People have shot up in the last 4 years getting on the psychedelic bandwagon, but they're bamboo, right? Small roots. You've got deep roots. You've been asking these questions for a long time, Stephen, and living them out in embodied ways. So today, I think, is going to be a really great conversation. We're going to explore not only your book, but we'll talk about your conference. We'll talk about all sorts of things that that you're a part of here, Stephen. So welcome to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to do it.
Yeah, let's start with your book, because I think it's a, you know, it's recent. It just came out last year, you know, and I know that it's called How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World. Visionary and Indigenous Voices Speak Out. I think you have something like 25 or something like that different thinkers in there, and it's like, I've read lots of books on psychedelics, but I've never read a collection of such diverse thinkers. You have Indigenous voices and female voices and people who've been in the psychedelic scene for more than 20, 30 years, and you've pulled them all together because you have relationships with them. So how did the idea come to do this book? Is it from the conference? You just had all these networks, but how did you come up with this idea of the book?
Well, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure. It just kind of, you know, slowly developed, I suppose. But yes, a lot of it must have had something to do with the conference, because I've been doing that for 11 years now. And excuse me. And so I've met a lot of people. 14 of the people who have spoken at the conference are in the book. 14 of the 25 contributors are in the book. So it was kind of an easy you know, process of connecting with people that I already knew. But just for a little fun story, I suppose you could say, similarly with my previous book, Cannabis and Spirituality, there was one encounter that was the turning point. With that book, by the way, it was a conversation with Kathleen Harrison, former ex-wife of Terence McKenna, and that's just a way of identifying her. She's a very powerful ethnobotanist and brilliant person in her own right. Nonetheless, I told her at the time that I was considering that cannabis needed this kind of information, needed this kind of education, because so many people use it, very few people understood it as a potential spiritual ally. And she said, well, you know, if you put that book together, I'd contribute to it. And that was the trigger that made me go, oh, okay, this book is going to happen. Similarly with this book, it was a conversation with Chris Bache.
First chapter, brilliant by the way. I'm so glad you put it there. You didn't bury it. You're like, we're gonna lead with this, and we'll talk about that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I hope it didn't you know, scare off some readers, because he really goes for the throat, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So anyway, I was having a phone conversation with Chris and told him similar kind of what I was saying to Kat Harrison back then, which was that you know, I thought maybe it would be good to put a collection of voices together for this. And but I'm not quite sure yet whether I want to go ahead with it. And he said, well, Stephen, if you do that, I'll write at least a chapter for it. And as soon as he said that, I was like, okay, we're on.
Yeah. Now we've got something. I can, I know. And maybe we start there, because, I mean, that's how you start the book. And I think that's really, it's a really brilliant, Chris's work, LSD in the Mind of the Universe. I mean, I think I've read that book at least three times now.
Really?
Because, wow. It was, it was jaw-dropping. I mean, the rigor, the scientific rigor that he does in these 72 high-dose LSD sessions over 20-plus years, the rigor he does in these 500 to 600 microgram sessions where he's, you know, dedicating 12 hours on a Saturday and then 12 hours almost, I don't know, he's listening the whole playlist again on the Sunday where he, you know, documents. And so there's an element of, someone might read it and say, well, that's just his one experience. And I'm like, yeah, but when you dedicate 20 plus years of your life and you're a rigor scientist and you're an academic, then you can't just dismiss it as just some personal experience. He mm-hmm. has developed a way to go back into these experiences, in essence, pick up where he left off and begin to kind of really look at what are the archetypal themes, what are the collective suffering of humanity, and where is humanity going here, as he looked at kind of, he clears each kind of realm and he moves into this kind of final, the diamond luminescence, the future human, as he calls it, as we go through maybe a planetary struggle like we've never seen before, and humanity might emerge, on the other side of that. So yeah, why for you was Chris's vision and his writing so essential to put up front?
Well, that might also speak a little bit to the reason for the book altogether, because I've been feeling and sensing and thinking that way for a long time, actually, that the karma is hitting the fan, as it were. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of reasons what we'd say factors involved in that, really. For example, I've been aware of multiple indigenous prophecies for a long time that all point at this time as being the kind of karmic comeuppance point, the time of great change, etc. Then there's common sense, which is like, how much longer can this dysfunctional, spiritually disconnected, dominating trajectory of the planet go on? Not much longer. And then there's the obvious, observable elements of the climate, which one way of thinking about the climate and what's going on the planetary level is that for, several decades at least, there have been a series of different elements or, components of this, like from the Antarctic to the Arctic, to the oceans, to the mountains, to the land, the rivers, all these things that have been somewhat discrete. That might be an exaggeration, but somewhat discrete. And now they're connecting more and more in the connecting of a feedback loop. So this very summer of 2023 feels to me like a turning point. And I actually had a conversation with Chris about this about a week ago. Called him about something else, but we had a phone conversation. I said, by the way, because I hadn't read LSD in the Universe for a while, and I said, I don't remember right now. Did you say that the climate would have something to do with this death and rebirth trajectory or cycle that you see us heading into? And he said, oh yeah, definitely. I said something like, and then as soon as he said it, I remembered, he said, a big part of the change, this is not a direct quote, but a big part of the change will be a series of escalating ecological crises, right? So he agreed that this summer also feels like a turning point. Like so many records of heat records and floods, and like right now they're having unprecedented flooding in Beijing, for example, in the middle of summer. It's just it's a tough thing to have to say to people in a way. I feel kind of bad about it almost, that it's just like a lot of people don't want to hear that, and I sympathize with that. But the reason, and again, this comes back to the reason for the book, really, is the reason for, yes, in fact, that is really the central reason for having wanted to put this book together in the first place, and I didn't really say or didn't answer you fully before, is that if indeed this is what's going on, and that's why Chris's book is chapter in my book is central, and also why I put it up front like that, is that if indeed this is going on, and I think it is going on, and I think we're going to see increasing signs of that quite rapidly, actually, in the next 5 to 10 years, I would think, the reason for sharing this kind of information is that if you don't have any sense that there could be a rebirth coming out of this at some point, There's no prediction as to when. It may not be in the lifetime of anybody who's alive on the planet now, actually. It could be 7, 8, 9 decades. It could be a couple of hundred years. But if you don't have any sense that this has been intuited, it has been seen by mystics, by deep psychonautic journeyers like Chris, and predicted by visionary indigenous peoples for 500 years or more, then there's a very good chance that you as an individual will fall more deeply into despair and depression and anxiety, and it's concomitant illness, if you will, of falling prey, because when you feel like that, you're very vulnerable, you're uncertain, and it's really difficult to be in an uncertain, fearful type place. And when you're in that kind of a place, you're very susceptible to false messaging by people who are essentially psychopaths and take advantage of that. And sorry to have to bring him up in the interview, but Donald Trump is the sort of like quintessential example of that in the Western world right now. There are many others, but this is exactly what's going on, I think, with that phenomenon, with the MAGA crowd and all that, is they're sensing, in an incoherent way, unconsciously, this change, this instability, and Trump comes along and says, well, we can make America great again. Oh yeah, no problem, right? Same thing that Hitler did when the Germans were vulnerable coming into the Depression after getting kicked around, for so long by the Western allies and so on, and hit worse than any other of the European countries in the Depression and so on. He comes along and says, oh, well, it's not our fault. It's not your fault. It's the international banking system. It's the international Jewish business community, including here in Germany, et cetera, right? So that's a danger right now that we're facing. So it's really important, I think, to share. Well, one of the contributors in the book is Duane Ellis. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't actually, it's interesting, he doesn't even mention psychedelics in the book. he posits the potential birth of what he calls a mature planetary civilization. And in the book that this material is sourced from, called Choosing Earth by him, and in the chapter, he lays out a possible, maybe even probable scenario, decade by decade for the next few decades, of kind of like in a different way from Chris Bache, but in the sense of things continuing to dissolve and, deteriorate. But then as that happens, potentially, this is like a big, if on that potentially, then we start to become more focused, more determined, more innovative, more creative, more compassionate, hopefully more of us anyway, and start to envision what can be done to create a world that's sustainable and, et cetera, sane, et cetera. And so what might, in Duane's vision, come out of that perhaps in 60, 70 years from now might be this, the beginnings of the birth of this mature planetary civilization. But again, just to sort of sum that up, Peg, is that I felt like more people need to hear that this is what's going on. Otherwise, as I mentioned a moment ago,
it's a despair cycle.
Yeah. And that's no good, obviously. Yeah.
I mean, you bring up Duane's article or chapter in there, and I mean, he comes right after, I don't know if he's right after, but I just remember like Zoe's chapter on kind of the rise of the feminine. And he talks about the rise of the feminine as well as like a necessary corrective to patriarchy and kind of what I'll call, Christianity's kind of control on our planet, with kind of a really patriarchal kind of vision of God and the sky God up here. And the rise of the feminine is kind of a new corrective to that patriarchy that can open up the possibilities of communal ways of being, indigenous ways of being with one another. And as you mentioned before, an engendering of compassion as the heartbeat of what it means to be human, rather than consuming. Right? Mm-hmm. A consuming mindset says we're here to just consume this planet, whatever thing, what Heidegger talks about, everything is standing reserved for our consumption. It's just sitting out there for me to consume whatever it is, meat or cattle or whatever. And we move toward compassion as our primary, what it means to be human is to be connected and to be social and to be compassionate. And it seems like psychedelics you know, from my experience, can help usher in that older feminine way of being that is mm-hmm. counter toward the way we're being right now. How would you respond to that?
I agree. And of course, and you know, you said it was a sort of a new way. In one respect, it certainly is a new way, because it's been buried, but it's also an ancient mm-hmm. understanding. And that's been one of the things that I've been very interested in these last few years, is realizing that, I mean, there's so many different ways to talk about it, and it just actually could be a long topic if we diverged into that direction. But let me go a little bit in it, if you don't
okay,
mind.
Okay, I love it.
Don't mind. Yeah. Okay. So here's just one simple way of putting it. Up until approximately 2,000 years ago, although it definitely started before that, there were pagan communities and societies all over the planet. Many after that too, in the places that the sort of Roman Empire hadn't yet gotten to, and that whole mentality. There were sometimes referred to as the mystery traditions. Many of these pagan cultures were. They didn't have any of the same kinds of repressions that the sort of Christian, you know, mentality overlay onto these cultures.
Deeply animistic, connected to nature.
Yeah, sex wasn't bad, yep. You know, et cetera, you know, celebrating life. And this may sound like a slight tangent, but actually one of my favorite authors is Martin Prechtel, mm-hmm. who was a shaman in Guatemala with the Maya there. And you know, he said when the missionaries started coming in, they didn't understand those missionaries. First of all, they were humorless, and that they couldn't relate to that. And secondly, they posited that, or they tried to tell the people that that they were living in sin and in a sinful world, and that there was a salvation. That you mentioned the sky god idea, yeah. Sort of later somewhere else, there's this salvation, you know, if you do all the right things and behave yourself and so on and so on. And they couldn't relate to that, because for them, this is the garden. Mm. It's here now.
Right.
It's not elsewhere. It's not later. And it's our job as a species to be, as Tyson Yunkaporta in the book says, a custodial species, right? Mm. So, basically what happened, and you know, I'm sure it's a whole, you know, complicated set of factors, was that the male dominator mentality took over, and it became cemented more or less by about 400 AD or of the Common Era. There's a wonderful book I really like. I was spending some time with Dennis McKenna lately. He also read it and felt
he's
the same
my neighbor
way.
By the way, just lives like a kilometer from me.
Oh yeah. Anyway, we were talking about it. We drove down to Portland together recently for a conference, and mm-hmm. I mentioned this book called Not in His Image by John Lamb Lash. It's a fascinating book. He did an immense amount of research, and he starts the book with a story about a Greek woman from she was from Alexandria, named Hypatia.
Yes, I've heard of her, yeah.
Right, so he starts the book with her because as a kind of a marker point of the kind of like the final nail in the coffin of the mystery traditions, because she was a wise, highly respected, intelligent woman from that kind of mystery tradition. And she was pulled out onto the street and slaughtered and ripped apart by a mob, which I would kind of identify as similar to that kind of Trump mob mentality, right? You know, like, don't threaten me in my little, you know, cocoon here. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's existed a lot on the planet before. And now it's more like coming back to recognize what's been missing. And so in that sense, it's not new. It's like recognizing what's been hidden. And as you already said or implied, it's like an essential balancing because they're the characteristics, or whatever you want to call them, of you know, sort of archetypally of women are that have been buried and suppressed and oppressed and ignored and disrespected by the dominator mentality are exactly the qualities that are missing, that yeah. need to be understood and manifested to bring us back into balance again. So yeah, that's a that's an essential component.
I, you know,
of
I think
it all.
Lash he talks about Gnosticism, you know, the idea of direct gnosis, the mm-hmm. idea that you can find the divine within. It's not this outside sky god, you know, that yeah. I have to perform for in order to get his, and it's always his approval on my life or blessing. It's that there, you have a direct access to that divine here in this moment. Like the very yeah. very different, I mean, and you can actually, I mean, I mean, this is now a rabbit trailing, but I'll do it. Mm-hmm. You know, Brian Mirarescu's book, The Immortality Key.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, you know, he really fascinates me because my background is, you know, came up as a ordained minister and then walked away from that that, you know, that framing because it was too small of a vision of the divine, right? So mm-hmm. his framing is that you can go through the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece, see the women that are serving the koukion, the psychedelic mix that all the initiates would go to, and you can see that through the Dionysian cults right into early Christianity, where the women are serving a spiked Eucharist as they do the ethnobotany and scrape out the chalices. You're finding in these mm-hmm. early first and second century churches a spiked Eucharistic wine that women served in house churches until in the fourth century, the Roman Catholic Church outlawed the direct access to the divine and outlawed accessing home Eucharist. It had to be done through a male in a church, not at home, not in a spiked Eucharist, mm-hmm. and not by women. And so he does a really interesting job of showing those early teachings, that Gnostic teaching was alive and well, even in the Christian tradition, until it was, you know, corrupted by the patriarchy again. Mm-hmm. So I'm fascinated by this idea that there are these streams, these mystical traditions that mm-hmm. have been alive, that have been buried, that we can find, you know, they're still around.
And, absolutely, yeah.
So yeah, fascinating.
And for me, everything comes back to a core spiritual problem, everything in a sense, because everything that we do is a function of our relationship to reality, to ultimate reality, if you want to call it that, or to the awakened nature, as the Buddhists might say. And so all of that stuff, all that male dominating, all that control, all that orthodoxy, you know, repression, it's all ego. It's all that that part of ourselves that's afraid of awakening, which is essentially everybody on one level. That's what we're working on in our spiritual work at this point, right? Is to gradually move away or see through, relax out of this ego identification, and allow ourselves to go with this flow, which again is, you know, part of the sort of feminine you know, ability, so to speak, the receptive and the openness in that regard, the allowing the heart to come out and all those kinds of things. So all that activity, all that Roman church stuff and everything that in Roman Catholic Church and all those ways of, you know, like slaughtering the medicine women yeah. and calling them witches, you know, in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, that whole era. That's all coming from that same place, that we think if we can control our world, then we'll be okay, but we can't, you right. know. And I also wanted to comment on your astute reference to consumerism. That's the same thing. You know, it's also been exacerbated by some Christian teachings that have told us that, you know, the world is ours for the taking. Yeah. It's been exacerbated by some of the, in the last 500 years, some of the sort of scientific worldviews that say all matter is dead matter, you know, Descartes and some of these kind of people, that all matter is dead matter, you know, that there's no life in the world. Whereas the, you know, the people that have seen these things, and again, psychedelics have had a lot to do with that for some people, but certainly indigenous people from many parts of the world have, you know, directly experienced the living intelligence, sentience, of just about anything. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if I have the book anymore. It's I forget the title. The subtitle is Teachings of a Lakota Sioux by Wallace Black Elk. He was a spiritual grandson.
Yes,
of the
he has
famous...
a vision that he got when he was like 7 years old or something like that. Is that right?
Well, I haven't read it for about 20 years, but it's, yeah, when he was around like 5 years old or something yeah. like that, yeah. he was talking with rocks, right?
Right.
Rocks, right? You know, Tyson Yunkaporta, I don't know if it's in the chapter. I also interviewed him on my YouTube channel. It might be there, or it might be in his wonderful book, Sand Talk. He said that, you know, tourists will come and take rocks from, they have another name for it. It was known as Ayers Rock folks, right? They would take rocks home. And he said, sometimes they'd bring them back because these rocks were causing problems in their house. And I mean, it's hard to imagine how people would actually identify that the rock was the source of the problem, but somehow they sort of recognized that there was a spirit in that rock and you took it away from its home and didn't understand what it was. And on that, if I may ramble for a moment, I tend to follow my intuition on things that interest me, and they sometimes pan out over the course of years. So there's another thing I know very, very little about personally, but I'm becoming increasingly fascinated about, and it's related to rocks. It's crystals. I used to participate in a lot of Native American church peyote prayer ceremonies, and the man who was the roadman or ceremony leader for many of the ones that I went to over a 12-year period, Ken Littlefish, told me one time, I don't even remember why it came up, but he said, crystals have a lot of power and almost nobody knows what to do with them. None of these people that are buying them in shops, you know, the sort of the new age shops or whatever, know anything about what crystals actually can do. So that was one thing. And then one of our speakers, speaking of the conference that you mentioned, the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference that we're having this year, is a young woman named Acacia Lewis. She is, I'm calling her a genius. I don't know if anyone else has used that term for her, but she's incredibly intelligent. And she's exploring these ridiculous, to me, ridiculously high doses of psilocybin mushrooms. But what she says, she says, first of all, you know, kind of like the, you know, standard disclaimer, don't do this at home sort of thing. You know, she said, to be able to handle these like 20 gram and up, you know, 20 dry gram and up doses, you have to have an extremely stable mind. You know, this is challenging, to say the least, to get into those spaces, and not recommended for most people at all. And even she said she had to work up to it gradually over a longish period of time. Nonetheless, she said, you know, what someone who can handle that level of dosage might consider doing is buying crystals in different places and having a collection at home, taking that ridiculously large dose, and then just communing with the crystals. And what you might find, which apparently she did, is that by no means all of them, but some of them contain a library of information that you can access. And so, you know, in reference to this notion that in many parts of the world, things might have been in more balance prior to the Christian era. I think going back even farther, this is loosey-goosey, you know, history here. This is not, you know, like hardened history here. But I think it's possible, and Acacia talks about this a little bit in some of her YouTube videos, that ancient peoples in some places understood crystal technology and were able to use it in remarkable ways. And so that, to me, why that's potentially interesting to me is I'm always interested in where we could be going. I'm not interested in the past for the sake of the past. I'm interested in what the past might have to tell us about where we might be able to get to or go to. And perhaps crystal technology is one of those. If there was a way to access crystal knowledge and crystal technology, it might serve our, you know, ability or capability of, you know, simplifying our technologies, you know, and
yeah, you know, that's very interesting. And I don't know if you'd heard, if you've ever heard of a podcast called The Emerald Podcast by a gentleman named Josh. I'll definitely put you onto it. He's into mythopoetics, and so he's really into myth and story. And he did an episode actually on the sentience of rocks. And he really spent a long time on, and he's a researcher and really done great work, but he talks about this device. Like he says, this iPhone is a highly specialized crystal device that uses silicone to be able to take wavelengths, capture, like, think about this. If you could take an iPhone back 400 or 500 years and say, what is this? It's rock, ore, minerals, crystal, and then electricity being gone through these crystalline structures that we have created to be able to beam an image of you and me we can see each other through crystals. I mean, it's really insane, right? So, I mean, it's looking forward remarkable. To the talk at the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference by this lady, because I think the wisdom around crystals, it doesn't have to be woo-woo, that we understand, we use crystals all the time in wavelength frequency, be able to take wavelengths and adapt them and be able to compress them and understand them. We need crystals for this. So I think there's a lot of science to be able to look at.
An interesting way to put it, with these little iPhones are quite remarkable devices when you think of them that way. So it all has to do, of course, and again, feeding back to the book and how psychedelics can help save the world, is it all has to do with us regaining our sense of who we really are as people, which is ultimately, you know, and I'm on the path, I'm not saying I'm up at the top of the mountain looking down and saying, hey folks, follow me up here, I already know everything. It's that I understand enough from glimpses and from teachings and et cetera, that our true nature, the unconditioned nature of reality, is pure peace. You know, it's, you know, not very many humans actually get to that state completely. So the Buddhists have a term, awakened heart, which I really like, because it's like, you don't awake without the heart, right? So the awakened mind is a mind of peace and compassion together, right? And in relaxing into it, as we learn to relax into that state, our natural state, then our intelligence goes up. It goes up significantly, because we're able to perceive directly, as you mentioned in, you know, a little while ago, about like connecting with God directly in that sense, right? Connecting with our true nature and our true intelligence, because we're not overlaying it with a whole bunch of confusing and complicating concepts, ideas, beliefs about what's right and what's wrong. That's all like secondary information that lives up here, right? So the path for us is to become increasingly calm and empty in that sense. Another one of my favorite authors, I've only read one of his books. He's a Buddhist scholar named David R., initial R., Loy, L-O-Y. Okay. He has a book, I think it's called The Great Awakening, and he really nails the sort of the psychological component or explanation of the way that the sort of what Buddhists would call the confused or samsaric mind functions, right? Which is that we're always trying to fill a hole that can't be filled, right? He said, when you can relate with that hole at the center of your being, that emptiness at the center of your being, no matter how uncomfortable it is in the perhaps earlier stages of doing that, then it starts to free you up to be who you are, to have that open heart, to have that intelligence. But we're, you know, the nature of ego identity is constantly trying to avoid that and constantly trying to fill that space. Hence consumerism again, right? Hence this notion that you think that if you buy something or it's consumerism. I think the Buddhists might have a better term that's more expansive or broad than that, which is theism. So the coming, or theo from God, means in Buddhist psychology, as I understand it anyway, what that means is illusionary belief that there's something out there that can save you, whether that's like literally the sky god that you talked about, or it's that if I only have the bigger house, the you know, the great wife, the perfect job, you know, anything, what it is, like if I'm, you know, anything that you don't have now. Sinead O'Connor just died. She had an album called I Do Not Want What I Do Not Have, or What I Don't Have, right? Good for you, Sinead. Honor that woman. That's why I say everything comes back to a spiritual problem ultimately, is that we're always in relation somewhere along a trajectory or continuum, where every single one of us is in some relationship to our natural, open, true, awakened self, and our behavior reflects our positioning on that continuum, right?
Yeah.
And again, psychedelics, because you know, one way of thinking about them is what I like to think about them anyway is when the patient is in a severe or advanced state of illness, you need strong medicines. So they're not for everybody, obviously, but they potentially in the right circumstances, you know all that, of course, Peg, and many other people do, in the right kind of circumstances with the right kind of container, protection, intention, and skill, and so on and so on, have the potential to unlock the stuff that's been buried and open us up not to some other thing, but to who we really are, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I even think of cannabis like that, you know.
You know what? I want to put a pin in cannabis because I have a huge thing about this, and we need to explore cannabis in a second. But I want to finish this little piece that you just kind of put on the table, which is why, like the title of your book, you know, how psychedelics can help save the world. And I heard you on another podcast going, "Ooh, that feels a little strong to me." Like, I don't want to put it that way. But then, your publisher said, "Okay, I guess we'll put help save the world." I think they wanted it how psychedelics will save the world or something like that. You're like, can we put help? Because it's not, you know. But I do love and I agree with your insistence on we are in a moment in history. Again, I get it. Everyone might say, well, we've always been in that. I think it's different. We are 8 billion people on this planet. We're experiencing climate and issues and catastrophes like we've never experienced before. We have access to technologies now that Oppenheimer movie just came out. Taking a new young audience to this place of like, do you know we have the capacity to blow ourselves up at any moment when these things get into the wrong hands. And let alone our planet is kind of suffering. And so at one level, you have to say, well, I guess we can continue as usual and we'll just do our best to kind of stop climate change. Or we need a full scale overhaul of consciousness to be able to create some kind of radical shift, moving away from the kind of consumeristic mindset that has got us into this hot water in the first place. And we need a shift out of that. And the only thing that's, at least in my mind, because I agree with you, the only thing that we've got available for us that can actually do a radical kind of give us a new operating system is these incredible plant medicines that can allow radical transformation in a short amount of time. Now I get this is not just what lets us dose everyone. I'm not just put it in the water and I'm not that naive. I do know that they needs to be kind of in containers. They need to be embedded in communal systems, which is why for me, I have such a passion to build group models of both prep, journeying and integration. I think it's called the Dunbar number, where it's like, most people, an average in a tribe, you can know about 150 people. And after that, you really lose trust and contact. And then you have to trust a person to trust a person. But, I kind of think of in terms of, can we plant psychedelic communities around the world where you get a kind of 150 people with similar worldviews in a community, call it a church, if you will, a spiritual community that help use entheogens to help us open up our hearts to one another and increase compassion, increase empathy, and kind of increase communal connection. I see psychedelics as the only hope for our planet to be able to have that kind of shifts. And you might say, whoa, you're putting a lot of emphasis on that. I have not seen anything in my lifetime that is, and I've been working as a minister, trying to help people transform, find their true nature. I've had seen nothing that even comes close to how powerful psychedelics can be to open up love, connection, healing, transformation, healing of traumas, connection, from past wounds. I sat in ceremony with an 81-year-old, a gentleman. He did a psychedelics for the first time. This was on Sunday. He said to me after, he said, with tears in his eyes, 50 years I've been looking for something like this. Mm-hmm. I've had so much trauma in my life, and I've done so much therapy. I've done so much talk therapy. Countless hours I've spent trying to find who I really am in this 12-week journey and this small community of people. And psilocybin, 3.5 grams, all of a sudden I know who I truly am. Mm-hmm. And all of the pain of my life, it begins to, has been dropped away, and I've kind of connected with who I really am. Wow, I have not seen that. Like that kind of radical transformation. That's why I'm on board with this kind of work, is can we build communities of connection using these beautiful medicines that and look to our indigenous brothers and sisters who have kept these ways of working with these medicines as kind of a way for us to look forward. And I think that's where your conference and your book is so strong. You do you put your indigenous wisdom up front and says, these are the people we need to be listening to, right? Not
Absolutely,
just
yeah.
the researchers from Johns Hopkins. We need to be looking to our indigenous brothers and sisters who's been living alongside these medicines.
Yeah, and it's the sort of overarching worldview and way of life that many of these people have, although they've been, almost shredded completely in many places over the last several hundred years, there are still threads of that understanding of earth connectedness. Ultimately, it's our relationship. That's why this whole notion of the, dead matter has been so problematic, because then it allows you to go, oh, we're gonna rip up a forest, no problem, right? That's what it's here for, or dig up the earth and pollute the rivers and all that kind of stuff. It's an inner disconnection from our true relationship to everything, and why also that notion that everything is alive is so important to understand as well. And again, why psychedelics can help with that in particular, for example. It's this whole notion of coming back to our whole overall connection with everything, right? And the indigenous people, oftentimes, I mean, for the skeptics in the crowd, let's be really, sort of objective, almost, you might say, about this. By no means has every indigenous community understood this, or every individual in any particular indigenous community or anything like that. Every community has been different. Every tribe, every nation has been different in certain respects, and their worldview has been different. But overall, on average, the people that have lived close to the earth like that have understood, as they have communicated to us, that they are in relationship. That's why they say, all my
All my
relations,
relations.
right?
Yeah, and that
Because
doesn't just
that's
mean
not a
humans.
platitude. That's a statement. That's a proclamation. All my relations, right?
And I mean, I would love to get some more comments on some of, you've had some really beautiful experience in the Native American church, and in peyote ceremonies and others. And what are some of the learnings that you got from those communities where the medicine and the kind of container and the spiritual community, it was embedded? Like, you don't just go do ayahuasca in Peru and then come back and go, hey, that we you know I just went with a couple buddies, we had a great time, and woo, an integration, whatever that means. It's like, no, these communities, it's a way of living with one another and being. Tell me a little bit about what your experience was like with working with and experiencing the Native American Church and some of their sacred ceremonies.
Can we hold that thought for just a
Sure.
second? Because there's two themes that you've mentioned that you've said so much that it's like, okay, I want to comment on that one, but wait a minute. Oh, I want to comment on this one too. So there's two things I wanted to make a comment about. One of them, as well as I do. Although, as you so eloquently put it, the psychedelics are, as a modality, are far beyond any other single modality for helping us awaken at this point. Nonetheless, they're really just a glimpse into those realities. And that's essential for a lot of people. But you might say the real work is every moment, every step, as my old Buddhist teacher put it, the walk of an elephant, every single step you take. That's the practice. Because, so maybe you do, a powerful psilocybin journey once, twice, three times a year, whatever. So what does that take out of your life? Maybe 24 hours altogether, if you add them all up, So that gives you another 364 days worth of time that is where your life is happening, right? So I think it's, an essential part of that is, you get these downloads, these teachings, these reminders, et cetera. And then you just have to keep trying to be as present as possible all the time, right? Just like aware of your thoughts coming up. I have this book somewhere, really interesting book called The Mystic Path to Cosmic Power. It's an old book from the 60s or sometime like that that apparently a lot of people read it, but nobody seems to know this guy named Vernon Howard. Anyway, he said, first of all, in the beginning of the book, he says, first of all, I'm not making this up. This is not theory. This is not dogma. This is experience source, you know, that I'm sharing here. Secondly, I also have read all the mystics, and they all would agree on this. And that is that the single most important thing you can do to wake up is that throughout your day, you don't have to be sitting down on a cushion to do this, but just notice the thoughts that come up. Observe them with no judgment whatsoever. You know, as our Buddhist teaching said, no praise, no blame, just a neutral, non-judgmental attitude toward whatever comes up in your mind, and then just release it. And it doesn't matter if it comes up, as Rumi would say, you break your vow 1,000 times, just keep coming back, right? It's that in itself that starts to take the steam out of the power of these things that are holding us back, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the integration is the common term these days. But integration is that other 99% of your life, right? Yeah. So then I also wanted to comment briefly on the Dunbar number that you mentioned, Tyson Yunkaporta talks about it. And again, I like to address the skeptics when these things come up, you know, because some people are going to be, oh, well, that's naive, or that's, you know, impractical. It's not scalable, right? Mm-hmm. And so what Tyson says is, yes, indeed, it is scalable, because what happens is, so that number again is like 150, as you said, where you can, you know, you can keep tabs on people that are getting off track, or that trying to gain power for themselves, or the sexual predators and things like that. But he said it is scalable because there's constant interaction between one node and another, you know. Right. Even Native Americans, for example, that had these small tribes, they understood that you couldn't just marry within the tribe forever, right? You know, you had to have these kinds of exchanges, trading and intermarriage and all that, to keep the health of the tribe going. So there's that. And now, especially maybe when we have all these devices that can help us be in touch mm-hmm. with other communities, at the interaction part of it. And now that I've said that, what was the question again?
Well, I was more, that's great. And I love Tyson's work, the Sand Talk. I just want people to go, you know, read that. His explanation of what he calls song lines is just so beautiful. Uh-huh. Like this way. Anyways, let's get back to this, your experience with the Native American church.
Oh yeah, right, that, yeah. Yes, good. Yeah. Yeah, so I was involved with them for 12 years. The main reason I stopped going was because Ken Littlefish, that I mentioned earlier, died at that time. And he had run, I don't know, 80, I probably went to about 36 meetings, probably 4 or 5 a year for those 12 years, something like that. That doesn't add up, does it? Anyway, somewhere in there, 35 to 40 meetings or peyote prayer ceremonies that they often called meetings over that 12-year period. And Ken ran a lot of those meetings as the roadman. He died. And then about a year or two later, a fellow that he had given the transmission to essentially died. He had a diving accident and became essentially brain dead. For my cannabis book, I wanted to find out the Santo Daime ayahuasca people, some lineages within that use cannabis also, Santa Maria. So I wanted to find out about that. So I met this guy from the local Santo Daime group and ended up going to one of their meetings. I'd never really wanted to before. I didn't like this idea of, you know, separating men and women, sitting up and in with lights on and dressing in white and in singing hymns that had to do with Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. But I went just to, you know, find out, and I loved it. They hold a fabulous container, as far as I can turn, a very clean container. And what all that other stuff doesn't matter, because it's your relationship to the spirit, right?
Yeah.
In fact, they even teach that, like, don't worry about so much about what's going on, you know, laterally. Keep your relationship this way, right? So then I got involved with them, because I could go 10 minutes for a 5-hour ceremony instead of hopping in my car and crossing a border, taking a ferry and a total drive of about 6 hours,
right,
and then staying up all night and doing the same journey back home.
Was this quite practical?
Yeah, it was, and I haven't been back since. But to actually answer your question, Right from the first time I went, I was blown away. And I still feel, even though the Santo Daime, I would say the Santo Daime people, as I say, run a fabulous container, but not quite as, I don't know, effective. It's not, there's nothing ineffective about it or ineffective about it, but there's just something about the Native American church peyote prayer ceremonies that, I don't know, it's just unparalleled somehow. As a container. You know, just one of many examples is a discussion came up one time about dark or harmful energies that can be
like malevolent. Is there, that's a great question.
Well, they can be evoked, you know, because you're opening up, you know, that opening can allow anything to come in potentially. And I could tell you stories about that too, but we'll save that for now. And Ken said, you know, that never happens here. You know, our container is so well protected, so clean, that it never happens here. We do not get those kind of energies coming into that teepee, but they're very meticulous about how they do it. Like when you put up the poles, they're all put up in the same order every time, and the way they cross each other above, exactly the same. Even the way they tie the rope around them is you know, it's part of the ritual. And Ken told me that all that stuff was taught by spirit. They have a water drum that they use to accompany the prayer, peyote prayer songs. And the way there's a long rope that you have like an elk skin or something that you pull across, you know, you put the drum together at the beginning of every meeting and take it apart at the end of every meeting. It doesn't just sit there staying as a drum, right? And they use an elk skin, and then they use like little rocks or something held in the edges of it. And then they rope around those, tie them under the bottom, and then they crank this thing down really hard. But the pattern of the ropes, there's two or three variations apparently, but the pattern of the ropes is very exacting, like a star or something like that. Again, supposedly taught by spirit, right? And Ken once said, you know, we don't have a lot of rules in here, but the rules that do exist are here for a very specific real reason, which is not to interfere with the movement of spirit. So for example, if somebody's praying with a tobacco, people sitting around a circle and there's a fire in the middle, praying with a tobacco, you do not get up and walk between them and the fire, because the fire, they say, is a spirit being. And if somebody's drinking or eating, they eat medicine, they don't drink it, eating the medicine, you would never walk in between them. Mm. And they also walk in the same direction. And you just, in general, you don't move around much in that teepee, like the participants like myself. Basically, you only get up once all night, which is around 12 to 1 at night. They have something called a midnight water, and they let half the teepee out for a set of four songs to go take a pee. And that might be it. You know, like if you have a problem of some kind, you might be allowed out, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning. But other than that, you're there from, you know, midnight till 7, 8 in the morning, 9. Actually, the meetings usually go till 9 or 10, sometimes 11. And I sat in one meeting that went till noon one day, starting at 9:30 at night. And you don't get up, right? So you don't drink water before those meetings, you know, or during. You learn that fairly quickly. They're prayer meetings, you know, when I first started going, it's like, well, what can I get out of this? Like, what can I learn from this? How can this benefit my spiritual growth? And I fairly quickly learned that if I just kind of put that aside and focused as much as I could on the prayer, because that's what they all are, they all are actually prayer meetings with a specific prayer. So there's a sponsor, and the sponsors asks for that meeting. And it'll be for a particular reason, which could be extremely serious, or it could be more lighthearted, like an anniversary or, you know, a birthday. Even there can be their birthday meeting sometimes, you know, but it could be somebody that they're trying to pray out of prison, or it could somebody who's dying with cancer or something like that, right? you know, somebody who just lost their husband or whatever. And what they do is they ask everybody in the teepee up until a certain point of the night, in particular it was around 3 or 4 in the morning, to pray for that prayer for all that time, for like 6 hours or whatever that is. So the songs, the prayer songs carry that, and the instruments get passed around the circle. And if you know any songs, you sing them. If you don't, you bless yourself, pass them on. But all those songs, each person leads a set of four, and if other people know them, then they join in. But they're all supposed to be this kind of like non-linear, non-rational, so to speak, or non-verbal almost, in a sense, way of praying for that person's request, the sponsor's request. So I've heard people talk about having like visual experiences with peyote, but in general, that's not that big a part of these things. It's not about that. It's actually about getting, more into your focused, awakened heart, you might say. Like really focusing. Like, for example, I never wanted to close my eyes for very long at all because I just felt like you're there with these people, right? And things are happening. Like somebody might beside you might be ready to throw up. They call it getting well, that they say that you only throw up when there's something that needs to come out psychically, so to speak.
Wow.
So but
I
maybe the
just want to
person.
comment, Stephen, all the things you just talked about, it talks about a way of being with the medicine and in a community that has nothing to do with my own personal mental health, my individual needs to deal with my depression. Like, and I'm not trying to minimize that. I'm just trying to kind of wake us up to this kind of Western way of thinking about psychedelics as a medical model of like two therapists, one person, we're going to sit in a lab, give you psychedelics, give you eye shades, let you be by yourself. And then we'll kind of mop it up with three sessions and then push you out. That's not at all what these indigenous communities have talked about. You've mentioned things like there's a certain way to create the safety in that container. There's a certain, there's certain understandings of how to keep out malevolent forces from a place. There's no one at Johns Hopkins talking about that. No one
No.
is saying, how do we energetically clear the facilitators that are going to move into these altered states? How do we get rid of, how do we create containers? You know what I mean? Like, we need that wisdom. Like, I just interviewed Rachel Harris's for her new book called Swimming in the Sacred, where she interviews 20 psychedelic guides that have been doing medicine, where all women underground for 20 years or more. She said that's how they got in the book. You have to have been doing this for 20 years or more. Now, these women are doing this in lineages and in underground ways. And the what they bring to the table in her book, in this Swimming in the Sacred, is exactly what you're talking about. They're talking about this is deeply spiritual work. You can't do this work as a kind of a as a scientist alone. You have to be open to spirit. So I just the stuff that you brought up just now are questions that most therapists that are wanting to get into this. It's like, I did a little MDMA, and now I want to be a psychedelic therapist. And you're like, holy cow. I mean, this is not at all the kind of lineage work that you're talking about that gets handed down by generations. And so how do we bridge this, right? How do we take and understand that these medicines come to us in these ain't big containers, deeply spiritual, and yet try to translate it into the Western mind? How do we do that?
Well, geez, when you say these things, it always just opens up so many possibilities of where we could go with this. Geez, here's one way. excuse me. We have a tendency. Okay, so just a brief comment about the Johns Hopkins work. I don't want to be too hard on that. I think it can be very effective, and they don't seem to have had much problem with like malevolent forces and things like that. It's a way to work with these medicines, which can be very beneficial for people. But as you implied, it's just one way. And also, I wanted to comment on the fact that you said, like dealing not about dealing with your depression and so on. Well, ultimately, it is, but it's in by taking the attitude of putting your mind in that space and the prayer that's going on, because probably the central reason why the Native American Church is legal in the United States for Native people anyway, they fudged it with people like me, is because they have been able to show to the Congress of the United States that people come into that teepee who are alcoholic, drug addicted, etc., heading toward a death spiral. And they come into that teepee, and the way they talk about it is that medicine shows you yourself. It shows you the truth of what's going on in your life, and it shows you that you have a choice. you keep going this way, you're done for. But you also have this option as well. So it really is also about healing. But what I found out, and that's what I was saying a few moments ago, is that the way that the healing happens for oneself is by almost forgetting about it, for me anyway. You know, pardon me. So now, geez, my train of thought isn't doing too well today. What was the question you were asking me to comment on?
How do we translate? I mean, I agree with you. Like, we need these insights from these indigenous communities. What kind of advice would you give us?
Okay. So first of all, that what I wanted to say about that, thanks for getting me back on track, is that I've seen this for a long time in our culture, and I'm sure you've seen it too and know it. We kind of have this attitude. I grew up with the hippies, or I spent time with the hippies. I was a hippie in the early 70s and whatnot. And a bunch of us were living up in the Kootenays, and because people were doing things they'd never done before, like building houses, blah, 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 there was this attitude, you've done it once, you're an expert. Mm-hmm. So we have this tendency in our culture to think that, you know, we know a little, and then now we can do it, or we know a lot. But traditionally, for example, in the ayahuasca world tradition, with the mestizo world of Upper Amazon and so on, you apprenticed for years, and oftentimes I think it was the shaman himself, your master or mentor, that told you when you were ready. Similar in other traditions, like the Native American church, you know, they start to see where somebody's ready, and then they kind of groom that person, and then they hand them a transmission in that sense. You know, and on that note too, I think it's really important to examine one's motives. Why, you know, like, why are you doing this? Is it because, okay, this is something I can do, I can make some money at, I can have some influence, I can maybe do some good work, you convince yourself it's good work, but you do it, you get into it with a relatively small amount of background and experience and training. The other aspect of that I was just going to say is that, like, I remember going to one meeting. It was actually a meeting to honor four roadmen who were all present that night. And this topic came up where the guy who was actually running the meeting said to the assembled, he said, "You don't want to be a roadman." He said, "You don't choose that path. It chooses you." And he said, "It's not an easy path. You know, you are responsible for the rest of your life. You've made a vow, you've made a commitment, you're accessible and available to people. This is your life. You know, it's a very demanding path." So I think it's supposed to be more like that, you know, similar with almost many traditions, you know, in the old ways. You know, the violin maker didn't, you know, approve the player to, or the apprentice to go out and start selling his violins until he could put that stamp of approval on it or whatever, right? You know, it happens in many different professions, but we have this impatience and this kind of ambition in this culture, which makes it problematic. So if I had any advice, you know, I'm not one of those people. I'm not a roadman. I'm not a ceremony. Well, I actually am with cannabis ceremonies, but I don't think of myself as a shaman. I think of myself more as a guide and a midwife in that respect. I would say patience and diligence and thoroughness and humbleness for people that are considering doing this kind of work. For example, in the ayahuasca world, they say, and I think it's true, that you don't really have the skills that you need until you actually have a relationship with the spirit of that plant, of the ayahuasca, and the songs come from there. I think traditionally it may not always be like that, but as far as I know anyway, they're called Icaros in Spanish. They're taught to you. They say that in Santo Daime too. They're all their hymns, they say, are downloaded. They're received hymns. And similarly, in the, you know, Amazonian ayahuasca tradition, they say they receive those Icaros and then they can use them. For example, I was down in Iquitos in Peru a couple of times. You know, the last one was about 12 years ago, something like that. And I went to this one place, and I had a really interesting experience. It's a fun story, but I won't go into it just for time here. Where about an hour hour and a half in after drinking the medicine, that particular shaman or ayahuascaro, they call him, would call each of the individual people up to sit in front of him. He would light a mapacho cigarette and blow smoke over them, and then he'd sing them an ikuro. And that particular night, I had taken a small amount because I'd had a super powerful experience a couple of nights before, and I thought, I don't really need another one of those right away. So I just took a small amount that night. Up to about an hour, I thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze, you know, just like a light cannabis high. I'll get to sleep about midnight and have a wonderful sleep, blah, blah. So I go up there at that point, you know, after the medicine would normally have kicked in fully, you know, reached its peak, you know, maybe an hour and a half in or whatever. And he does that. And I walk back to my cushion, and literally within about a minute, this effect level went from about like a 10% up to about an 80%, almost as strong as the one from two nights before where I drank three times that much, right? Yeah. So in the morning when we had the sharing session, I said, yeah, I told him that. And I said, did that have something to do with the ikuro you sang me last night? He said, oh yeah, absolutely. He said, those ikuros are spirits. And they come in and they say, I'm the song for this person, for this situation right now, right? So if you don't have that relationship, I think you're missing something essential there, right? Or certainly extremely important in your work, if you're a ceremony leader, whether it's with, I mean, I don't know where you get it from if you're working with psilocybin, because we've had our traditions cut off for the most part. But somehow I think people ideally need to have that relationship, really take your time. If it were one piece of advice I would want to offer to people, it would be take your time. Don't be in a hurry to step out there and call yourself an ayahuascaro, a shaman, or whatever, you know, when these with these powerful medicines, it's a long process. And ideally, you have a mentor, and you never really lose track with that mentor.
Yeah, you know? Like it's because it's an apprenticeship model. And I think I think that's what we need again. I think we need apprenticeship, almost like a guild, where, you know, medicine people, whether that's facilitators or medicine people, can kind of belong to an apprenticeship guild where they can be, you know, there's a bit of supervision, there's a bit of structure, there's ongoing, you know, elders that can kind of help you, you know, because this work, unlike, you know, unlike therapy, I mean, this is really clear. This isn't therapy. It might be therapeutic, but it's not therapy, right? It's a different. It's more spiritual than that. And so you need to be able to be doing the work yourself. They call it, like, I'm working with one indigenous elder that's just kind of connects with me. He talks about hollowing out. Like this process of you getting into relationship with the medicine is you're clearing your own biographical data and in your whole life so that you can have this kind of be an open channel to be used by spirit for other people, or else your own stuff's going to get triggered all the time in these medicine circles.
Yeah, that's the idea.
That's a life work.
Absolutely. That's the aspiration. And, you know, a simple way to think of that is that person then is what I would call a professional. You know, a professional is somebody who knows their tools, knows what they're doing. You might think of a musician that way, you know, like some of the great, you know, like jazz players like Charlie Parker and them. I don't know if it was him particularly, but I've read this about people a few times. When they're like 16, 17, 18, they essentially lock themselves in a room for a year or two for 10, 12 hours a day to get to the point where their technique is not an issue anymore. So whatever's coming through, it just goes right into the fingers or whatever, right? So to me, that's what a professional is somebody who knows what they're doing, and they're serving that in that way. They're serving the muse of music or the spirit or the person they're working with in ceremony. By the way, I think any good therapist has to sort of have done that inner work themselves too. Not, you know, obviously if they're not working with psychedelics, it doesn't have to be through psychedelics, but if you I've been around that world enough to know that I think it's generally agreed upon by the people that really are those professionals that you have to have explored the dark side and the pain within yourself. You don't have to have healed it all. That's, as you say, a lifetime's work, but you have to have known those territories for you to be able to work with other people that way. And similarly with psychedelics, you have to have been in those places. You have to know what it's like to face what Thaddeus Golis in a lovely little book called The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment called A Satanic Bummer.
That's quite a line. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen, you know, as we kind of bring our conversation to a close, I put a note in early, but I really want to get back to it.
Yeah.
I because you've written a lot on cannabis, and I think it's a really important one that I don't want to miss. I just read, I mean, it was last year, but I reread it now. Daniel McQueen's book on psychedelic cannabis. He's out of Denver, and he has this kind of, and he starts the book by just saying, we don't have the luxury to wait around even for the legalization of psilocybin. We've got a legal plant that's right in front of us that has this profound, it can be the queen of the plants, right?
Yeah,
that cannabis that has a profound psychedelic ability when it's used in a context and when it's kind of layered in with other modalities, like, you know, whether that's a sound healing, a body relaxation, and a blending of a kind of a high THC sativa with a high THC indica, and kind of in a blend like that, we can get these incredible big altered states that are different than just a cannabis high. I mean, I've used cannabis for a long time and it's been wonderful, but I've never really experienced the kind of medicinal or spiritual experiences until I kind of looked at his work and then attended a cannabis circle and had a profound mystical experience that would rival any psilocybin experience I've ever had. You've been very familiar with cannabis. Comment on the power of cannabis to actually engender spiritual and mystical experiences and even psychedelic ones where you are not just high, but you are in an altered state.
Well, first of all, although some people would disagree, I do consider cannabis a psychedelic. Technically, or whatever the word is, scientifically, chemically, I guess you could say it isn't, in the sense that it doesn't act on the 5-HT2A receptor system. But functionally, it qualifies, because the word psychedelic itself is the manifesting of the psyche, right? Or mind manifesting or soul manifesting. And also the synonym entheogens, you know, engendering the divine within. Cannabis is fully capable,
yes,
and just as you said, you know, of doing those kind of things. And so, oh God, there, you know, I mean, you've just opened a whole nother can of worms here.
You know what? Maybe maybe this becomes another episode where we do a whole thing on cannabis, because
sure,
to me,
let's do it.
Like, but it's so important.
Yeah, that'd be great. But I will, let's you know, since you brought it up, let me make a stab at doing a sort of 25 words or less kind of comment. Because one thing that occurs that I want to say is that I think cannabis is vastly underrated for its potential in this regard. It's clear that, you know, if you're approaching, you know, psilocybin, even though you might do it recreationally, it's pretty obvious to you, you're going to be dealing with a really powerful mind altering plant. But cannabis, you know, people use it so casually, so recreationally, so often for numbing, for sort of almost what you might call addictive functionality, et cetera, et cetera. That's few people understand what you just talked about in that way that you did it yourself. Not many, not enough. And I think one of the ways or reasons that cannabis has such immense potential is because it's unique in the way that it does that amongst the psychedelic substances. When you open to it, you know, if you can bring your mind into focus and quiet your mind to at least some degree for part of the time, it's very difficult to do that for all of the time for anyone, regardless of whether there's cannabis involved or not. Like, how many people can sit still for half an hour and not have a thought? Eckhart Tolle and nobody else,
right,
basically.
Right.
Anyway, or some Buddhists can do that, you know, masters of, you know, the whole thing. Anyway, and cannabis can actually be, I actually consider it an advanced spiritual medicine, because it can, what it does is it amplifies in a neutral way, and it amplifies anything that comes up. So it makes your thoughts seem really, you know, important or whatever too, right? And tempting and seductive, and also that, oh God, this is where it's hard to put it in a few words, but I'm going to try anyway. A central Buddhist teaching is that ego's primary strategy for avoiding our natural state is by creating a smoke screen of overlapping thinking. So cannabis can bring up these, you know, ideas that you think are wonderful, but it's really tricky because that's the same way that your ego is functioning to avoid the surrendering, to avoid the opening, right? So I think it's really important with cannabis, if you want to think of it as, or want to use it as a spiritual aid or ally, is to, you know, as Terence McKenna said, maybe not completely as literally as this, but sit down, shut up, and pay attention. Mm-hmm. You know, so allow space in your mind. But what, where it has so much potential on a planetary level, as I feel, as sense it anyway, is that because it's so accessible, so inexpensive, you don't need a shaman. I mean, it can be helpful to go to a ceremony with a guide. That's what I do. I lead cannabis ceremonies. Mm-hmm. But you can do this on your own with a little discipline as well. And it's safe in that sense for most people. That's a whole other topic. Some people shouldn't use cannabis, obviously, and it's malfunctioning for some people. But it's basically safe. You actually used the word embodiment at one point. Mm. One thing that I consider, one way that I think cannabis is unique amongst the psychedelics, is that its way of working is by embodiment.
Yes.
By bringing you into the body.
Yep.
Yeah, it is. Whereas, you know, it's not like that with ayahuasca, for example, right? You know, you might still feel kind of crummy on the physical level, but you're not even focusing on that. You're having these experiences in the spiritual realm or the mental realm or the astral realm or whatever. Whereas cannabis, it's just a nowness medicine. Mm. It's about bringing you into this moment, you know, through the breath, the medium of the breath, relaxing, paying attention. And then that, as that happens, I mean, that's basically the sort of it's really just meditation.
Yes.
It's like amplified meditation.
It's,
and when I say meditation, I just mean simple, follow the breath, pay attention, emptiness, kind of formless almost meditation, right? So
but,
I think
but
cannabis,
it has, like, you know, and this is Daniel McQueen's language, but I liked it because he says it's a consensual medicine. So what he means by that is that you have to consent with where it's going. You unlike, let's say, psilocybin or some of these other ones where it's like, put on 5 grams, it's grabbing you by that ear and says, we're gonna go have a talk. Whereas cannabis, it's like you have to consent and lean into the work as a meditator for it to kind of pull you up into, and at any time you go, I'm done, you can turn over on your side, take your headphones off, stand up, and the psychedelic experience will shift, and you'll just feel a little high, right?
Yeah. But
that's a very, and that's another thing where, why it's such a, it has such potential for our planet, because again, it needs your consent to work with it. So there's a kind of almost a break, again, built into it, right?
Yeah.
You're not gonna, yes, you can get super high, but the kind of high that, you know, we're talking about like this is a high that's meditative. And so when you build it, you know, when you consent with breath work, body relaxation, meditation, and these kind of tools, and then you add cannabis into it, and then you put it into a circle or a community with intentionality, it's a powerful community medicine. So I'm excited about exploring that and the potentiality of doing that. I would love to bring you in to host some cannabis circles for our communities that we're doing, Stephen. I'd love to have you as a guest and help lead some of those. That would be beautiful.
Yeah, I really like doing those, actually. I just did one at the Sanctum Psychedelia Conference in Portland, which, you know, one thing that's wonderful about that is that few people have actually used cannabis that way. And these are people that have done all these other psychedelics too, right?
They're right here. It's legal. Yeah. You could do it tomorrow. Yeah.
And they come up to me afterwards and they say things like, that was amazing. I've never thought cannabis could do that. Right. Like, I'm going to change my relationship to that plant now.
Oh,
you know?
Man.
Yeah.
Just that line, Stephen, makes my heart. I could almost weep. If people could have a new relationship with cannabis, because it's sitting here and it's been kind of considered like we use things like weed, getting high, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is such a sacred medicine that it's sitting right, you know, in our cupboard here. And it's, you know, and it can be a powerful, like my wife and I use it for marriage and enhancement and connection, you know, so we'll intentionally set intentions, both kind of get into a meditative state, smoke a bit, and then connect and sit and talk about our relationship. And we're able to navigate things that we would never be able to navigate with ease, you know, outside of that kind of place. So think of, I mean, I do this with my grown daughters. We'll have mm-hmm. we'll set intentions around a cannabis circle with our family and use that as a way to connect and navigate in our relational dynamics as a nice. Family.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, this is, it has profound impact. So this, mm-hmm. let's put a pin in this because I am really excited about this. And I want to dig into some of your insight on this one.
Sure.
We're going to have another episode on cannabis as deeply spiritual medicine. This conversation, Stephen, is I feel like I've found a friend here and we've got to continue to have more conversations like this.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you just want to kind of say to our listeners as we kind of close off here, as we kind of wrap things up?
Well, I don't want to stretch this out particularly any longer, but I do have one little phrase that I want to add into what you were just saying about cannabis as a vision for what two of the contributors to my cannabis book called The Sacrament of Peace. Mm. I just had this vision while you were speaking, or just phrase came up, or word, term, I mean, peace pipe, the peace pipe, right? Mm. It's like, you know, many Native communities had that notion of you pass a pipe, and it's a way of connecting, sharing, right? And so now to have that, if the cannabis became increasingly used that way, as you say, in a shared way, I mean, I could just envision all around the planet people having circles, sometimes going into deep meditation with it, emptying into it, and other times, as you said, with your family and whatnot, sharing the peace pipe, you know? And if you know how to work with that plant, again, it is as an advanced, you know, spiritual practice in a sense, because it's the way to maximize its benefits is to learn how to calm down and open up, right, in the body, through the body, through the medium of the body. The wonderful mystic, poet, priest, whatever, a bunch of things, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin said,
beautiful, yeah,
physical energy must be mastered for spiritual energy to manifest, right?
Beautiful.
Physical energy must be mastered for spiritual energy to manifest. So I think cannabis is ideally suited to aid that kind of work. Yeah.
Thank you. I want to encourage people to get your book. It's a beautiful book because you have so many unique contributors. and there it is, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World. And also check out your Spirit Plant Medicine Conference in November. We'll be there. Dana and I will be there. We'll have a booth out there. We'll see some of the folks. Really excited about that. You have such beautiful speakers coming to the stage. So many indigenous thinkers and elders talking about psychedelics and indigenous wisdom, and a thank you that you're putting that on, and it's just it's a beautiful thing. Stephen, thank you so much for this time today. I'm really excited to continue our conversation in the future, and we'll definitely connect on doing a cannabis circle together. That's what I'm really excited about.
Cool. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Yeah, happy to do it.